Okay, this is...
We're exploring The Art of Game Design by Jesse Shaw.
A Book of Lenses. It was published about a decade ago. I read through it near that time and made lots of notes. And now we're just reading through all of the lenses. We're not being particularly fair to the book because we're not reading the whole thing. And Jesse admits that he really doesn't know what a game is. And we both have strong views on what a game is. It's kind of a cheap shot, but it's been fun, and we don't have time to read the whole thing, and not the interest either. He starts off in chapter one with the designer, which is telling you about yourself, and I feel like he has strange views about the designer. Like, he seems to think that he's writing for people who are at once very experienced and interested in game design and want to really get deep into the mechanics of it and the how it works and how it all fits together, and people who are just really, really unobservant and don't know anything about game design and have no clue even what a game is or what they want out of it or what they want themselves in life. And it may be because this is a textbook.
He also seems to be confused still about who the designer he's talking to is, but if he's talking to someone who's a single designer, because he has a lot of things in here where he's talking to someone talking about how they need to care about all these different aspects. You can't just care about mechanics, you have to care about everything about the game. Says they're all of specifically equal importance, which would be true if you were designing the game entirely alone. But it's not true if you are a designer or developer on a team. Then you're being paid to care more about one thing, and you still have to care about the other things because your thing affects it, but what you're getting paid to do is your one thing, and you have to pay more attention to that. And then sometimes he talks about being a member of a team and, like, checking to make sure that the stuff that you're doing actually fulfills your team's needs. So, are we a part of a team, or aren't we a part of a team? Because he seems confused.
Right. So, what we're doing is we're reading through 20 lenses at a time, and then going back and kind of reviewing them. So, we have a lot of discussion over the lenses and stuff in the course of reading them. And then we're going over and trying to recall the highlights of the discussion. So the experience is the first lens, and it's also the second chapter. So he's got one lens in chapter two, the lens of essential experience. And so he identifies you're trying to create an experience for the player. And I would agree that you're trying to create an experience, but it's not just any experience. It's an experience that would be difficult for the player to have normally. So, like, you're not going to create a game about going to the bank and trying to withdraw money and not having any money in your bank account. Like, you can get that experience anywhere. Anybody can have that experience. You want to create a game about something that's difficult to achieve, like going to the moon or having a killing spree or something like that, where it's both difficult and costly, something you wouldn't really want to experiment with in real life, something you'd want to know what you were doing before you engaged in. The lens of surprise, the lens of fun, the lens of curiosity, the lens of endogenous value, how do players feel about the game, the lens of problem solving. All of these lenses seem to be about trying to figure out what your players want and what you want. It's the problem statement of, like, okay, what are we going to address, and what is it that we have to say about it?
One of the big shortcomings of these ones, I think, is that he really doesn't cover the concepts themselves. He asks, like, is your game fun? If it isn't fun, how could it be more fun? But he doesn't really cover how to assess fun. And especially from the perspective of the creator, it's really hard to objectively assess your own work and say, is this a fun thing? Have I created something that other people will enjoy? Because it's become, well, for most people, I think, it's become so clinical to you by the time you've even got to the point where you can experience your game as a game instead of as something that doesn't compile right now. It's become such a clinical thing that you can't honestly assess it, and that's not really a fault, that's just the way people tend to work. So how should you assess whether a game is fun? Because you're looking at it and you're saying, well, honestly, I can't look at this as anything other than what it is.
Yeah, he doesn't do a great job of defining his terms. He's just kind of hoping, and like we said at the beginning, he admits that he doesn't quite know exactly what he's talking about. And so one wonders why he went through the trouble of writing such a large book. Maybe it's, we've speculated that it's based on a textbook formula where you've got a lot of things and hopefully the teachers will be able to draw out the things that they like and emphasize those parts and not make their students read the parts that they don't like.
Come on now. You know the teachers are just going to sign entire chapters at once.
Yeah. Oh, the other thing is that there are 100 lenses. So that seems like an oddly specific number.
Yeah.
Large round number of lenses.
There are a few things in here that he does at least get close to a good point. The lens of curiosity, he talks about what does your game make people curious about, and is that what you're trying to make them curious about? And we discussed how a game also ought to try to... Or I think you asked, what could your game make people curious about that they aren't already? And we talked about how Kerbal Space Program did a really good job of that, where on the tin, it just looks like a fun space toy. But if you really engage with it and care about getting good at it, it makes you genuinely curious about, well, how do orbits work anyway? And why is it so hard to get my spaceships to go farther? And you can wind up instilling curiosity in people, and it instills curiosity in me about orbital mechanics and about rocket engineering. And I went ahead and learned those things for no other reason than I wanted to be better at Kerbal Space Program.
Yeah, I think it makes a number of good points in those sections. So then we come to Elements Chapter 4 and Lens Number 7, the Lens of the Elemental Tetrad, which are mechanics, aesthetics, technology, and story. I feel like identifying these characteristics are really good. Like, these are good elements to break out. But then he says something very odd, which I will read.
This is what I mentioned briefly earlier, where he's talking about how the game designer needs to focus on each of these things equally. And while that might be true of an individual designer, isn't necessarily true in a group.
Yeah. It's important to understand that none of the elements is more important than the others. And then later he says, game designers tend to believe that mechanics are primary. Well, yes, they would. And he even says that mechanics are what make a game a game.
Which seems true.
Yeah. But then, believe me, as a game designer, they are all your piece. So, it seems like he does have ambivalence over whether he's speaking to someone who's running a company that designs games and has to care about all these different aspects, and someone who is just a game designer and doesn't have to make art and technology and stuff like that. Still, of course, you should care about them, and you should care about how the mechanics fit into those things. But this is another point that we brought up earlier, so it seems like he doesn't quite know which of three possible things he's trying to address with this book. Because he could be addressing any kind of design, where the first chapter and the second chapter are kind of like, well, okay, you want to draw on your own experiences, write what you know, that kind of thing, instead of mimicking the artifacts of others in the same field. So you don't just want to mimic other games, because then you won't have anything unique to say. And then you may as well just play the other games instead of making a new one that's just a clone of it. That's true of games, but it's also true of all artifacts. And so it's not particularly enlightening about games themselves. Sure, you can say that you should have make it something that the players will enjoy. Well, yeah, but that's true of cooking and of building houses and anything. Like, anytime you're designing something, you want to do it so that your client, your target audience, your market will enjoy it. Like, yes, but that doesn't tell us anything about games. And then there's stuff that seems to be targeted at media. So any kind of communication or entertainment or media, movies and books and writing and making drawings and making paintings and all that kind of stuff. Has to do with presentation, has to do with themes, has to do with informing the audience along many different avenues and about having repetition in what you're saying, but not too much. And there's a lot of things that you can go into making an artifact designed around communication, making a piece of media. But again, that doesn't really tell us much about games specifically. Certainly, yes, okay, if it's a piece of communication, and it's a media thing, then you have to have aesthetics. Yes. But that's not what makes games games. It even admits it in the Elemental Tetrad. Okay, well, mechanics are the things that really makes games games. So, but then he spends a lot of time on story and aesthetics and technology. Okay, but if this is a book about game design, then shouldn't he just be focusing on the things that are the game part and tell people, okay, this is important, and you need to go to somewhere else to read about this because it's been discussed lots of times in books about movies and movies about movies and books about books, and, you know, all these elements are important, but they're discussed elsewhere, and they're not what we're here to discuss, which is game design.
Here in the Elemental Tetrad, he also has a little graphic where he shows, he ranks them from visibility to invisibility, essentially. Mm-hmm. And he has technology at the least visible, which seems upside down, because the technology, unless he's specifically talking about video games and referring to graphics APIs and things like that. But since this is a book about design in general, technology is just the stuff you're using to put your game on. So it might be computers, it might be paper, it might be a board game or whatever, which is the most immediately visible thing. And it doesn't itself directly communicate anything about your game. But the first thing you see when you sit down at a computer is a computer. And the first thing you see when you open a board game is the board. And you have to take a step from that most visible thing to the next most visible thing, which is the aesthetic, the art, which he has on top, which is correct. Well, maybe correct.
But it's a strange graph.
Yeah. But the technology enables one to see the aesthetics, and the aesthetics enable one to experience the mechanics and the story, and those three then really work together to communicate with the player. The technology is kind of a foundation that the others all have to build on, but it remains the most visible thing. And so the danger in bad design is that you bring people out of the game and you expose the technology to them again. And like, oh, I'm just looking at a computer. This is silly.
Yeah, it does seem like his graph could be improved a lot. The way that I would draw it is, well, this is more difficult to draw, too. Maybe he's not a very good artist. The aesthetics of this graph are lacking.
But he wants to care about his art just as much as he cares about his design.
The way I would draw it is to have a loop where the player puts input into the technology. The technology puts input into the mechanics. The mechanics put input into the aesthetics. And the aesthetics inform the player of what's going on in the game. And then that process, as it proceeds through time, produces a kind of spiral, which is the story of what actually happens, and which is a combination of the choices the player is making, the way that the technology filters those choices, the responses of the mechanics and how the mechanics interacts with the choices, and then the aesthetics that arise out of all of those processes, and then inform the player and you know, proceeds to help them make different choices or change the way they're making choices. That still has all four elements, and I feel like it's a truer representation, but it doesn't make a tetrad, so...
There's an interesting conversation to be had there, where the game you described has an immersion story, where the game itself isn't a vehicle for a particular story.
Right.
But lots of game designers are looking to convey a particular story, and they want the rest of the things to kind of serve that story. So,
and I would say, since I have strong views on this, that there's no point in making a game with a set story, except as the vaguest framework. And that if you really want to convey a particular story, you should make a movie, you should make an animation, make a book, make some form of fixed story media. Because if you're just trying to convey a story and get people to engage with it, then why do you have mechanics at all? Like, are you just asking people to solve puzzles so they can unpause their movie or like get to the next page of the book? It seems like a very strange design decision as far as game design goes.
On the other hand, story can be used to establish stakes. So we'll take two pretty similar games, very different in time frame, but Warcraft 3, which has a pretty strongly present story, and Planetary Annihilation, which has a backdrop, but there's essentially no story being told, and certainly no fixed story being told in Planetary Annihilation. And the story in Warcraft 3 sets up the levels and gives them weight, because you can see here are these characters and they're interacting in this way, and here are the cutscenes or the in-engine scenes between levels show you what the characters care about, what the characters are trying to accomplish, what the challenges are that the characters are facing, and then you get to kind of live out the their success, their victory in overcoming that obstacle, or sometimes not overcoming that obstacle specifically. Where Planetary Annihilation is just, you're a robot trying to take over all the other robots, and one day you will die, and then the game will be over. And that isn't very compelling, and that's a part of why I have really never played Planetary Annihilation single player, because the game is fun, as, you know, mechanically, it's fun to play, but there's nothing in the presentation of the game that really keeps me coming back to it on my own, so I'll play it with friends, which is how it was designed to be played, I think, and so that's fine. But the single-player mode at that point is really just kind of a tack-on, where I treated Warcraft 3 very much the other way around, which I realize a lot of people didn't, but Warcraft 3 I kept coming back to because it was a compelling experience on its own, and it didn't need to be kind of propped up by the social aspect of playing it with other people.
Yeah, there's certainly something to be said for motivating the player by narrative and informing the action that the players are taking or the choices that they're making in the context of a larger narrative. But I don't know. I mean, it's certainly in neither game is the story overriding. Neither of them are just like a choose-your-own-adventure, click on the next thing.
Right. It's not like it's Tomb Raider or something where you don't even get to choose your own adventure. They have already planned the adventure for you. You just need to figure out all the buttons that you have to push to get on to the next scene.
Well, that is kind of true, though, in Warcraft 3. Like, you have to press these buttons to get, you know, your guys to move around to beat the level. But there's a lot of depth in the mechanics in that beating the level part of it. So I guess my objection then would be to have a game that where the story overrides the mechanics, which you wouldn't want, I don't think.
Right. That's what people complain about with like in cutscene events, you know, you're some unstoppable badass and you've been running around murdering people by the thousand, and then you get into a cutscene and some chump just like socks you and you go down. You're like, wait a minute, I just murdered 1,000 men and I get punched out by this one dude. Don't I have any hit points or something? No, you don't have any hit points in cutscenes. The cutscenes are going to undermine the mechanics and sell plot in place of consistency.
Right. And Warcraft 3 does do that to a certain extent. There are mission objectives and contrived things where you have to beat it in this way, or you have to get these units to this place, and it doesn't really allow for any kind of emergent gameplay. In some of the levels. Some of the levels are pretty good, where it's just like, defeat the thing or whatever. And they've done a fairly good job, but there is some degree to which the story kind of constrains you to playing the game in a certain kind of way. I would be happier with Warcraft 3 if it had options, if it had some branching in the storyline to allow you to to take wildly different paths and make different decisions.
That would be pretty interesting. And I feel like that's actually a venue where it would be relatively straightforward to do it. When you're doing like a really high def, you know, super realistic world where all the levels have to be particularly designed so that the player can, you know, are we sure the player can reach this location where we want the player to reach? Like a Tomb Raider or something like that. It's really, really expensive to add a branch because now you have twice as much to do after that branch. But in an RTS, the levels are... I'm not trying to trivialize level design in an RTS because it's still important. But the art involved and things like that is a lot less expensive. If you want to lay out your level a little bit differently or if you want to make your level a little bit bigger, you're not spending the same magnitude of additional effort as you would in a high poly first person shooter.
Right. And the end game for both Warcraft and for many other games who use a linear story is kind of a sandbox. They use the story as a transparent tutorial where you learn the units and you learn the mechanics and you learn how to play the game by going through this story. And it's linear because they want to introduce them in a specific order, and they want to introduce them from easy to difficult, or from early game to late game, or whatever it is. And then when you finish the story, or even before you finish, you can go play multiplayer or play random matches or whatever it is, and then you're engaging with the mechanics directly without the hindrance slash support of the story.
Right.
And in that way, having a story makes a huge amount of sense because it's a way to inform the tutorial of your game. So I guess the objection then would be to games that don't have anything to do after you finish the story or don't have a game at all, right? I guess it's the same thing.
Right.
If the story is all there is, then it seems like you haven't really made a game.
On the other hand, and this is something actually Extra Credits talked about yesterday a little bit, a lot of people respond really well to a feeling of agency even when the agency isn't really there. And so they were talking about, what's that game? Oh, Assassin's Creed. They were talking about Assassin's Creed recently came out with a new mode that's essentially a museum tour of some of the ancient Egyptian landmarks. And they were praising the idea that, you know, this got made in the first place. You can go to these landmarks and it kind of walks you around and shows you. They've got sound bites that tell you about the thing, and they kind of describe the history of ancient Egypt a little bit.
Cool.
And they were praising that this is a really great thing, and it's a kind of a novel use of games, and we need to encourage it. And then they criticized it for not letting the player have more freedom. And they said, well, right now, once you start a thing, you can only go forward. You just walk through the thing and you hear all the sound bites in order and then you're done. And so it's essentially just a museum tour. And while that's fine, games aren't museums, and people, at least some people, will respond better to it if you let them run around on their own. And maybe they don't discover your sound bites in the order that you were hoping they would discover them. But they'll still discover your sound bites, and by discovering them in the way that they wanted to discover them, in the example he gives is they remove all the parkour elements of Assassin's Creed during this mode, and so you can't do that's like climb an obelisk.
Sure.
He says, but some people just want to climb obelisks, and if you let them climb the obelisk, they'll get to the top, and then you put a soundbite at the top of the obelisk. And so now you're giving them what you want them to get as a reward for them doing something that they want to do. And
You could give them the same soundbite if they read the plaque or climb to the top of the obelisk.
Right. And then he mentioned things like you could put little markers around the town, so if they did something unorthodox like that, like climbing an obelisk, they could look and they could see, oh, there's another soundbite off in the distance over there, I should get over there, and then let them parkour across the city to get there instead of just walking. And that's going
to
be...
Yeah, to take mechanics out of your game seems like a terrible decision.
Or at least kind of a naive decision. Yeah. And, they suggested Ubisoft probably did this as kind of a cheap way to pitch an educational aspect to see if they could start getting games into schools and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that by removing instead of adding, it was cheaper and, fine. That's fair. They don't have infinity money to spend on this. But the general idea is that people, when given a feeling of agency, whether or not the agency is really there, because if you're just running around a city doing parkour and occasionally stumbling across a soundbite, you're not actually changing the world in any way. So you don't really have any agency. But it feels like you have agency because you can decide when and where you encounter soundbites.
Mm.
And so the same thing, I think, is true of a lot of, you call them walking simulator games.
Yeah.
Like Life is Strange or something like that, where the story is going to unfold in probably a fairly predictable manner and probably a fairly consistent manner where it's going to be the same every time. And so you could just make it a movie, but by making it a game, it's more about kind of exploring the experience of the characters within the game at your own pace and in your own order. And so again, while it's more difficult to tell a story that way, and from the perspective of someone who just wants to consume a story, maybe more frustrating, by giving the players the freedom to experience things in the order and at the pacing that they want, and by giving them a sense of agency, even if they don't really have one, since their actions aren't going to substantially change the game world, you open up the player's experience to the things that happened in the game are now a thing that they want to happen, and so they're more invested in the experience, so they're more likely to get some personal...
gratification?
Yeah, personal gratification or something like that, or personal understanding of the characters and the scenarios the characters are in. I think that's part of what convey.
Sure. So it would make sense for them to put the mechanics in and allow you to explore this environment at your own pace and in your own way. But if they weren't going to do that, then the question remains, why did they make a game out of it? Why didn't they just use the engine and make a bunch of in-engine cutscenes where the camera swings slowly past this model and you hear the text? I mean, then you wouldn't have to walk between the things and it would be a much more dense experience anyway. And you'd have the same amount of choice.
Because then you can't pitch this to teachers as we're bringing games into the classroom as an educational, which is...
okay.
Like, but that's a specific goal of some teachers. Like, how can I get games into my classroom?
Yeah, but deceiving teachers about the nature of the object that you're presenting them doesn't seem like a good reason to do something.
I'm not defending it. I'm just saying this is an understandable perspective.
Oh, man. All right, so now we've got holographic design, unification, resonance. We're back to kind of talking about figuring out what you want, figuring out your themes, kind of broad literary ideas of write what you know and stuff like that. Draw from experience, that's the write what you know one. The lens of infinite inspiration, lens number 11. Stop looking at other games and stop looking at other books and things and just look at your own life and figure out what experiences from your life you want to convey to people. Okay, that's good advice, and it's always good advice for any time you're trying to create something, but not really about games specifically.
There are also a number of things in here about identifying theme, and holographic design was about looking at your game as a whole rather than as a bunch of parts.
Mm.
And I feel like that's meaningful and kind of touches on one of the deficiencies that we had, or that we pointed out about fun earlier, where... Yeah, you do need to... You can't just focus on one element. If he talks about in that chapter how to actually see your game as a whole instead of just saying, try to see your game as a whole, then maybe that's informative towards using that clinical feeling that people tend to get when they're on a project from.
Sure. 8 filters, the problem statement, the lens of mitigation, a risk mitigation, which is a good one. There are a number of good insights in here. The lens of the toy is a really good one about would your game be fun even if there were no goals? Let's see.
I feel like since this book was originally published, there have been several games that came out that proved the answer to that can definitely be yes. Because I think this book was essentially pre-Minecraft or pretty close to pre-Minecraft.
It was around the same time. He's probably writing it before Minecraft became a social sensation.
Right. And it was before Kerbal Space Program. And those two games kind of stand out as examples of really computer toys, more than computer games, that have been wildly successful.
Yeah. The lens of the player, and finally, the lens of pleasure.
the lens of pleasure, we gave him a lot of crap for that, and I think he deserved it. Because he, if only for the one line where he says, try to imagine what new pleasures your game could evoke from your audience. If you're not sure what pleasures you might invoke, why don't you look at lists of known pleasures, which I don't recall that being a popular thing in 2008, but...
he might have access to some kind of arcane library of, like, just whole shelves full of pleasures.
Yeah, and he talks about unclassified pleasures, which...
Yeah.
I feel like the pursuit of pleasure has been a constant in humanity for the last many thousands of years. And there aren't a lot of corners that we haven't explored.
Yeah, yeah. He seems to have a very strange definition of pleasure here. And we speculated maybe you're talking about, like, okay, well, we're trying to corner this very specific, the pleasure of having coffee right after waking up, the morning after finals are over. And, like, that feeling of energizement from the coffee, but also the relaxation and relief from finishing finals. And, like, that is a specific, unique kind of pleasure. But, like, who writes down a list of those things? And more importantly, like, that is not a helpful piece of advice.
Right. And it goes back to kind of the one about fun, where, well, yeah, everyone wants their game to be pleasurable in the sense that they want their game to... They want to enjoy being there, right? Everybody wants their game to be fun because they want to enjoy being there. But thinking about how can I make my game more pleasurable in this specific category is just how can I be better at what I'm trying to do? Because that producing an enjoyable experience is kind of the definition of your effort.
Yeah. So then Chapter 9 has the player... It's called The Player's Mind. The game takes place... Or the experience takes place in your player's mind!
Because of course it does.
Yeah, but he has three good lenses here. We're pretty impressed by the lens of flow, which has to do with achieving the goals that your game has in a way that responds to the player's skill level. Staying in that flow state where it's not too challenging, but it's not too boring. The lens of needs, where he talks about Maslow's hierarchy and how you can try to address all of the levels on that pyramid. Although it seems like the top level and the bottom level are the one very abstract and the other very concrete, fairly easy to address, as we've seen in Minecraft, that it addresses both creativity and needs for food and shelter at the same time. But the center for love and belonging and human companionship seems like it's very difficult, probably because that's where our human experience rests most directly. We're not... just a body that needs food, and we're not just an abstract spirit that needs to express itself. We have this very human desire for love and physical companionship and spiritual companionship, and it all kind of comes together there in the middle, which maybe is why it's so difficult to make games that do that.
I feel like there have been games more recently that try to get closer to that sort of thing, but I haven't any of them, so I can't.
Yeah, and this book certainly has been... a touchstone in the game design community for what needs to be done and or where we can advance better, and just kind of a lot of different angles, a lot of different lenses with which to view game design. So it certainly is not completely useless, but it seems like it could be improved a great deal. And finally, the lens of judgment, which I think is really, I don't know, it seems like it's really close to defining what a game is, where the game, he says the game needs to judge people because people want to be judged fairly, and so you turn to a game which has systems and metrics of ways of, you know, making sure that your judgment is fair and measurable. I don't know, you had something to say about that, Nate.
Yeah, he was saying that you need to ask about your game, what about my player does the game judge? Does it judge it fairly, and how can I improve on the quality of that judgment? And he...
Oh, and do the players care about the thing that you are trying to judge?
Right. And I wish I could think of the example, because I remember specifically complaining about a game where the game had a system that purported to rank a particular skill set or something like that. But what it generally ranked was the quality of your friends, right? Like, you could be as good at this as you wanted, but if you didn't have a whole team of people that were at least middlingly good, you were never going to succeed. And I think that happens a lot in skill ranking systems, maybe, in competitive games.
Destiny or Destiny Raids or something like that.
I'm trying to think of the mechanics of Destiny.
Was that
the main problem in Destiny?
Or was it like Farmville?
Well, no, what came to mind as I was saying it was skill ranking systems in games like Overwatch or League of Legends and things like that, where ostensibly the skill ranking is there to bring up how good are you at this game.
Sure.
But particularly at low levels, skill ranking is much more about how good are you at finding teams that will work together in even the most rudimentary ways.
Right.
Because, and that's where...
Because everyone has to be good at it, or at least middlingly good at it, to be able to play the game effectively.
Well, and they don't even particularly need to be good at it, because what it's really scoring at those lower levels, and this is where the term Elo Hell comes from, is will your team work together? What it's scoring you on at the lower levels is, does your team work together?
Mm.
Because...
Can you coordinate?
Everyone in these games is terrible, right? Maybe you get, you know, somebody who's just naturally talented and you're shooting people in the head. You have somebody smurfing or something like that who's already amazing at the game, but by and large, everybody in, you know, the Bronze League or something like that is terrible at the game. Or at least, at the very most, they're kind of medium okay at the game.
Sure.
And the teams that succeed, and therefore the people that move up out of those ranks, are the teams that work together. And so skill ranking in Bronze and Silver is generally more about, can you put together a team or create a team around you that will work together to achieve goals? Because since everyone is terrible at the game, all you need to do is get like 3 or 4 people on your team of 5 or 6,
right,
that will work together towards a common goal, because the other team probably doesn't have that, and now you have the advantage of numbers.
Sure. Which seems odd that the rank matching systems don't allow you to, or generally don't allow you to have any input into what your team is built out of, like how your team is constructed.
Right. And that's true if you're playing by yourself. And so my experience with those has been that I get ranked more highly when I go through the ranking process with my friends.
Yeah.
Part of that is my friends are better at the game than me. But
right.
Part of it is we're more likely to succeed because we are talking to each other.
Yeah.
And we know how each other play and we work well together. And
sure.
So it's more about teamwork than it is about individual skill.
Sure.
And then much, much, much later, where working together well is kind of a given, then skill ranking is, well, are you the best person at playing your class? Or
yeah.
But it's kind of weird where skill ranking says it is a ranking of your skill,
mm-hmm.
but early on it certainly isn't.
Right. And I feel like a lot of that lack of allowing for player judgment comes from this misguided idea that you shouldn't let players judge each other. You know, that everyone should approve of everyone else and we're all here to have a good time. It's supposed to be fun, right? But I imagine that it wouldn't be too difficult to make a system where you can just, well, you can certainly mute voice chat, right?
Yes.
And it seems like you should just have a system where you can mute team involvement. You get into a lobby or something and the voice chat is just on and you can say whatever you want, anyone else can say whatever they want, and then you can just mute all the people that are saying things that you don't like, and then you don't play games with them, right? Like, they're not on your team. And it would be a really easy way to get players to take other people out of the match.
I think Overwatch actually may have a mechanic like that now. I think they recently added it, or at least they've been testing it on the public test server, where you flag someone as avoid this player.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't kick them out of the match that you're in right now, because that would be pretty harsh.
Sure.
But it does, the matchmaking system will then try not to put you together with that player, and so you can say, well, you're just the worst, let's play with someone else.
Sure. And then it incentivizes you to talk on voice chat and engage with the game so that people will want to play with you in the future, and
right.
So it's easier to get into matches in the future.
Right. Well, I think we've done a summary.
Yay!
And that's the end of the episode. Join us next time for more talking about game design book. Talking about game design. Talking about game design. Talking about game design. Talking about game design.